everyone. I'm now on Patreon. Click the link below. Not only keep the free content coming with tutorials, tips, podcasts, etc., but get a bunch of free stuff like live stream Q&As, copy of my book, voting on topics, behind the scenes, bunch of cool stuff. Click the link down below to join. Hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 7 of the Scott Stokely podcast. And as I promised, I'm going to be shooting this from nothing but the coolest exotic locations there are. So right now I am right in front of Maroon Bells outside of Aspen, Colorado. I know it looks like a black and white photograph on the wall of a Super 8 in Grand Junction, but it really is Maroon Bells. And I'm wearing a t-shirt because it's not 8 degrees outside right now. And I am not hiding from the cold weather like an old person. So I'm in front of Maroon Bells and we're going to leave it at that. So as I've said, I'm going to be all over the place with this podcast. I'm going to talk to lots of interesting people in the disc golf community that aren't part of the pro tour. However, I'm also going to, and I'm going to use the word, I'm going to use some of my friends on the tour to put eyes on the podcast because the tour has such a huge following these days. I'm going to catch up with my old friends who are out on tour and who have a following, and hopefully we can put some eyes on my podcast with them. At the same time, I want to introduce my people. A lot of you guys don't follow the pro tour, to the coolest people out on tour. And maybe we can do a little bit of co-promotion there. So I have with me Paul Ulibarri. Now, I'm going to introduce you, Paul. I'm going to don't blush too much a little bit. But when I came back to the sport after being gone for 13 years, you had a reputation already. And this is in 2014. And you probably have heard this before, but your reputation was the most professional player on tour. That is something that I heard not once, but multiple times from people, that you were the epitome of how a professional disc golfer should carry himself. And I always thought that was really neat. I mean, what a cool badge to wear. So you guys, this is Paul Ulibarri. Paul, thank you for talking to me.
No, thank you for having me on your podcast, man. I'm super excited about this for sure.
Yeah, no, it's going to be, I'm really looking forward to this. So I got a bunch of things to talk to you about, but let's go some quick background for the people that, you know, like I said, my audience doesn't know as much about you as the touring audience. They know all about you.
Sure.
But you, when did you start playing? Where you won a major amateur title? Like, give me a quick overview.
Yeah, so I got into it in 2005. I was a young kid. I was 16 years old. My dad and I kind of got into it together from a best friend that was playing a lot. And, you know, just like anybody, I caught the disc golf bug and I was addicted from that point on. And I come from a sports background, so I was playing a lot of different sports, basketball, traditional golf and stuff. And then all that went to the wayside as soon as I found disc golf, and it's been my life ever since.
So you've been playing since 2005?
Yep.
All right. And where were you?
I was in Arizona. I was born and raised in Arizona, all over the place. Born in Flagstaff, raised in Cholo, and I spent most of my adulthood in Phoenix.
So then that makes you kind of a unique player, because if you have, I mean, you have a quality finesse game, yet you came out of Phoenix, and that's kind of hard to do out there. I mean, golf in Phoenix is a different brand of golf.
No, absolutely. It's definitely power hyzers galore out there. Yeah. But I was lucky. Like I said, I grew up in Cholo, Arizona, which is about 7,500 feet. So it's a lot like Tahoe or something like that. Lots of pine trees, very tight woodsy golf. And I grew up in a really small town, probably about 10,000 people, but was lucky enough to have three really great courses while I was there. And now there's probably 6 or 7 courses in a really small area.
I know it's insane, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, you've been watching the change since 2005, and even since 2005, it's wild. In fact, one of the questions that we'll talk about is people want to know about how much the sport has changed since you got into it, which to me feels like so recent.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
in 15 years, it's a different game. So you were playing at a younger age, you were athletic, so you got good quickly. When did you go to Am Worlds, or had you been to previous Am Worlds? Or
yeah, so I played for about 2 months, and then I found out that that the amateur junior championships was in Flagstaff. So 2.5 hours from where I was living, and the club that I was playing with and my dad and even my school helped me get out there. And I played that as my first ever PDGA event, which is actually really cool. A fun fact about that is during that junior worlds, I played with Macbeth, which was his first tournament as well. I played with Macbeth. I played with James Conrad, Devin Owens, a lot of really great players that came out of that AM Worlds. And then fast forward 1 year from that is when I won my amateur world title. So I've been playing, I like to say like a year and a half, but probably a little less than that.
So you won AM Worlds after just over a year of playing.
Right.
I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting because one of the rubs, and you've probably heard this, there's two camps about the amateur division. One is you stick around because you want to learn how to win and you want to learn the skill of playing with a lead and all those things you have to learn. But there's other people that say move up really quick because then you play with better players. And
that was my only win in advanced.
That was your own, really?
Yeah, I had played some advanced tournaments and lost, so that was my only win to that point.
But you were like hanging out 11 months and 29 days just to get a world title. You actually just won one, and then
I was one of the classic like I didn't know that you weren't supposed to do that. You know what I mean? I just was like, oh yeah, I guess we'll just go try to win this thing.
Then tell me what happened then. I mean, like, give me a quick synopsis. I mean, did you, like, was it wire to wire? Did you come from behind? I mean, what happened?
It was. I was never in the lead group the whole time, and I shot a really good final round to be one stroke out of a tie to be in the finals. And I think I was 5 or 6 shots back of the lead going into the final nine. And my putter got hot, and I made, like, 5 or 6 outside, you know, I think outside like circle 2 and caught this guy on the last hole. I made like an 80 footer to catch him and push it to a playoff. And I ended up winning in the playoff. So it was pretty exciting for my first ever advanced win for sure.
Yeah. No, you just gave me a case of PTSD because I remember many tournaments back in the 90s where there was a player, I don't recall his name, but there was a player that used to always break my heart.
Yeah.
Things like, really, I'm like beating you and you're doing, but then you're amazing when you need to be. So who was the player?
Brent Koontz was the unfortunate victim of my late final nine heroics,
right?
He had a putt to win though. He had a putt from about 25 feet after I made the 80 footer and he missed it a bit high, so he had a chance to put me away.
Okay. And then you went to sudden death.
Yeah, we did a 3-hole sudden death playoff, and I ended up winning.
Did you birdie to win, or did he?
It was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, so we actually played a few wide open holes, and then I remember we finally got to a wooded hole, where I learned, and I remember thinking like, oh, I'm gonna win, like this is a pretty easy shot for me, and I actually caught a really good break and like hit a stump and like rolled towards the hole, and he took a 4, and I was high. Over.
Gotcha. All right, so I quit playing in 2001, and I vaguely kept up for a few years. But when you started playing in 2005, like, who were the names? I mean, who were the players that you were looking up to?
You know what? The best players at the time, Dave Fellberg was right there as being the best. Ken Climel obviously was still the best. Avery Jenkins was the coolest. You know what I mean? Sure. Steve Rico was close to Arizona, and I had tight connections with him because he's really close with Dan Ginley, who was a big mentor for me in Arizona. I remember Chris Sprague was really good at the time too. Like there were some great players for sure.
How many players were out touring back then? I mean, I remember a few in the early 2000s, there was maybe a half dozen. Had it grown by 2005 or 2006, or is it still straggling?
Stragglers. I think probably about 10 were on tour. If I, you know, from my history, knowing the people now, I would guess that there would be like 10 people out on tour. Probably maybe less less full time, but you know, those guys would hit like the national tours and stuff, probably like in between 5 to 10, I'm guessing.
Okay. All right. So there were 5 to 10 guys out on tour. Did you have the vision of being able to tour at this point? Because I mean, if you're a kid now, even though no one's getting rich, you could still look at Paul and Simon and Eagle and go, there's a dream there. But in 2005, did you see it that way? Or did you really think bread and bologna, people couches, like,
they tricked me. The tour tricked me the big time. So I went to my first ever big tournament that I played was the United States Disc Golf Championship. So I won AM Worlds and I come back and you get the free bid into the USDGC. And Dan Ginley was like, hey, you can come with me. I go every year. So that was my first, you know, big tournament. And you know how prestigious that is. And it's well run. And they, you know, I was really into traditional golf when I decided to go on tour. So I kind of knew the tournament flow of that. And it was very similar, the United States Disc Golf Championship. So I was like, oh, this is what it's going to be like. Like, this is what I want to do, you know? Oh. And I actually had a scholarship when I turned 18 to play traditional golf at ASU. And I turned that down to play disc golf, which was like really, really silly. But
I'm sure you got second guessed by other people.
Oh, my parents were so mad. So mad.
So what was the... what was the career that, I mean, I know, well, maybe trying to pursue the PGA and all that, but I mean, aside from that, what was the career you would have pursued in college had you decided that a cubicle was more fun than traveling the world?
I was taking like pre-classes for like business management, you know, the regular thing that you do when you're a kid. I didn't have any like big time goals as far as education went. I was into sports, you know, and that's what my main focus was. Like, I played traditional golf, you know, every weekend, and I played a lot of junior tournaments. College wasn't really something I really wanted to do, you know. I wanted to get out of the house, travel, and be a professional athlete is what I was thinking.
Gotcha. So what year did you first actually hit the road?
I went, it's a good question because 2006, I won AM Worlds. 2007, I turned pro and I played a few tournaments. So I went to like the Beaver State Fling, United States, Florida, a few tournaments I actually got out of the house and traveled to do. And that's when I really kind of dipped my toe into the touring life, and I struggled big time. Like, I was missing cash at a bunch of tournaments and stuff. And it was like, I was definitely second guessing my not going to school. You know, I had already lost my scholarship and everything, and I'm like, well, this better work type thing. And I went full time 2008.
So, well, who are you traveling with?
Early on, I was really close with a kid named Corey Sharp, and he would come to stay with me. He was a super talented player back then. In 2007, he won Rookie of the Year over Nicola Castro and myself. So he was a good player. We're still great friends to this day, but he has a family now and type thing. But I was going over to, he was from Utah, and I would stay in Utah over the summer, and he would come stay with me for that 1 year in Phoenix during the winter. So he was my travel partner.
So how did you make ends meet then if you weren't cashing or barely did?
I was hustling, man. I would play, you know, we would play local events, and there was at one point where I was in the gross scum water of Fountain Hills getting discs to give to spinners. You know, at one time they told me, they were like, hey, we'll give you they at the time they were giving $2 store credit for a disc, right? And I was like, hey, you give me $1.50 for cash. And they're like, yeah. So me and my friend, we went to Fountain Hills, and I went like neck deep into that crud, and I ended up finding like 750 discs in one night sneaking around in there. And then they had to give me all that money. So that was when you're eating ramen and potatoes, like $1,000 will go a long way.
Yeah. I almost think everybody should have to do that. You know, and again, this is talking like an old person because, like, I think people had it made in 2005 compared to, like,
so,
you know, back in, like, the, you know, well, Glenn Whitlock was the first guy to tour as a disc golfer.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you do know the story about Glenn when he toured, how he survived.
I don't. Please tell me, please.
Oh, my God. Okay. So Glenn Whitlock, he was touring in the 80s, and then no one else toured until 91, which, by the way, was Dan Ginley. Dan Ginley was number two. Well, I called – there's people that toured in frisbee and disc sports, sure, but actually on the pro disc golf tour, tournament winnings is how I eat. That type of touring. Glenn did it in the 80s for a few years, and he was a professional eater. Like before, I think Kobayashi started, you know, made hot dog eating famous. When I talk about Glenn eating, and people go, oh, I got a buddy who could, like, totally, you know, eat a lot of food. And it's just like when you tell someone you play disc golf, and they're like, oh, I got a buddy who's like a top player. They don't even understand what top player means. Same thing with competitive eating. Glenn could sit down and eat 8 to 10 plates of food at a sitting. So he would go to all you can eat restaurants. He would eat once every other day. And he would sit down and he would eat 8 or 9 plates of food when he did. And he would make money on the side in eating competitions. And eating competitions might just mean loser pays for eating for the meal, but that would be free meals. And then he hitchhiked.
No way. That's so incredible.
That was Glenn. He would go to a tournament and then he would find somebody that lived in a town that might have a tournament in the next several weeks. He would ride with them back to their town and he would stay with them. He never drove. Like the transition of touring is Dan Ginley was the first player to tour in a vehicle where he actually had a car, a truck. So yeah.
Pardon me.
So the transition from that to I had it made when I played, because sometimes I would, you know, I could win a couple $100 at a tournament. That was crazy.
Yeah.
Compared to Glenn. So you're out on the road, you're doing the bread and bologna, people's floors. Totally fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was still in Phoenix, so I would save up money to go to one of the bigger tournaments. You know, it was pretty expensive to go to the tournaments. I didn't have a car, so I wasn't, you know, exactly – it wasn't exactly easy transportation. You know, one of the funny things that I did, you'll like this, is I used to go to the casino, and they had, like, this promotion for – at past 1 a.m., they did a thing called Aces Crack. So you could sit there at the poker table, and if you got pocket aces and somebody beat you, you got $100. And while you're sitting down, you get points so you can eat the food there. You know what I mean? Like, the longer you stay, you can use this at the restaurant, and you go, oh yeah, I stayed here for 7 hours, and you get a free meal. And so I would sit there all night and I would wait just for pocket aces. I fold every hand, obviously. Unless I had pocket kings or pocket aces, that was my rule. Like, I wouldn't play any other hands. And I would, like, sleep a little bit, wake up, play. And once it ended at like 7 a.m. And I had a buddy, he's still my best friend to this day, one of the best people I've ever met in my life, brother to me. His name's Floyd Campbell. And Floyd had a house right next to Vistas El Camino. And I would sneak into his house through his doggy door and stay during the day and sleep as he went to work. Like, I knew his schedule. So I would, like, sneak into his house. And then eventually, like, 2 months of doing this, I swear to God, 2 months of doing this, I wake up in his computer room. I'd sneak in the back, you know, make sure I didn't get caught. And then he came home and he was on his computer when I woke up, and he goes, quit sneaking in through the doggy door, the key's on the counter. And this guy, like, let me stay with him from that point on. I roomed with him for on and off all the way till a few years back.
God, that is beautiful. I absolutely love it. Part of why I wrote my book was because I wanted to share what, like, it was awesome. I mean, it's like, at the time, there's moments that weren't as much fun as they sound now.
Yeah.
But it's still like, nobody has bad memories of this. You know, everyone has memories that are positive. Yeah, I remember going to a tournament one time where we had 8 players in a 1-bedroom hotel room, and because that's what we could afford.
Yeah.
You know, because we all back then probably kicked in $4 a piece for the night. Whoever after Saturday got the bed and the other 7 people on the floor. Oh, and by the way, there were world champions in the room. It included Jeff and Johnny Lissaman, Frank Aguilera, Scott Moore, Sean Sheldon, big names. And these are big name players in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it was like, I got $4. What about you? I got 3. Ah, shit. I'll cover you for the other dollar. Like, that was real.
Yeah, that's crazy, man.
It is. So, all right. So you're out there. You're traveling around. You're scrapping to get by. But your game is probably blowing up because touring is the fastest way to get good at disc golf. I mean, would you agree?
No, for sure. So then 2008 comes around and I was on and off. One of the things that happened was at the United States Disc Golf Championship in 2006, I played with Felberg on the feature card, right? Because the Am World champ plays with the U.S. champ, the reigning U.S. champ. And so I play with this dude and we get to hole 17. He's having this great round, right? And he throws it out of bounds a couple times, of course, and he's pissed. And I'm like this young kid. I have no clue about etiquette or anything like that. I don't know anything about any of this. And I'm like, well, I'd love to have you around, you know, something like that. Right. And he looked at me and he goes, that's because your good rounds are my bad rounds. You know, and he's like in the heat of the moment. I'm sitting there and I'm like, who's this guy? You know, I don't even know that it's a sport really at this point. Like, I'm just there. Right. You know, I've been playing like a little over a year. I'm like, Jesus. And so I made it a goal that dude ain't ever gonna beat me, you know. And so fast forward to the end of my season in 2007, I struggled the whole year, but then I went to this tournament where I got to play with him. Like, it was finally a tournament that I actually played good at, and I got to play with him, and I had that in my mind. I'm like, this dude ain't gonna beat me, you know. And I ended up almost winning this A tier. So I hadn't really won anything and I almost won an A tier. So that's the breakthrough that you were talking about where I was like, oh, so I can compete with like the best in the world for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then I made that decision to do that in 2008. I was like, all right, I'm going full on.
Gotcha. So, and so I personally, I love Felberg.
Me too.
I absolutely totally understand when someone says they don't, I'm like, I understand.
So, yeah, now I totally get it. You know what I mean? I'm like, dude, why would I say that? But I just didn't know at the time. You know, I was just a punk kid, whatever.
Yeah, no, Dave's great. You want to hear a quick Dave story?
Love it. Yeah.
Okay. So I was at I went to Am Worlds in Kalamazoo just to caddy for a friend, and I'm set up in the Fly Mart, and I'm downstairs. Actually, a real quick aside, Paul McBeth was up autographing discs upstairs.
Yeah.
And so I went on my Facebook page because all the AMs were following me, right? Hundreds of them. And so I blocked Paul on my Facebook page and I posted, hey, if you're at AM Worlds right now and at the Fly Mart, go up to Paul and ask him if he knows where Scott Stokely's booth is. So apparently the whole night people were coming up to him asking him where to find me. I thought that was funny. but anyway, so Dave, at that tournament, Felberg was there, and
yeah,
a couple days before I made my pick for who I, my top 10 picks for Pro Worlds. I just picked, you know, just one of the typical social media goof.
Sure.
Picked Colleen to win, by the way. And, but Dave wasn't on the list. And so Dave comes up to me.
Of course. Yeah.
Of course, he comes up to me in the Fly Mart. He's like, Scott, he goes, I've been top 10 for the last 11 years in a row. Like, how could you leave me off your list on the top 10? What are you doing? And he like chews me out in front of everybody. So he walks out of the room and I get my phone and I make a top 20 list for Worlds and I leave him off. And so Dave, I'm not making this up. So Dave comes back in about 10 minutes later. He's like, dude, I've always been nice to you. Why are you disrespecting me like this? This is bullshit. And he chews me out again and storms out of the room. So I go back on and I make a top 30 list and I leave him off. And no one knows this is going on, but I start getting comments. Why no Felberg? Why no Felberg? Because he's Dave Felberg, right? Hall of Famer. And so Dave comes back in again and he's like as loud as I've seen him get. He's pissed off. And I'm like, I'm just laughing. I can't stop laughing. I said, Dave, I go, you're going to want to stop because I can do this all night because it's really, really to me. And you're getting mad and don't do it. And by the way, Dave came up to me the next time I saw him. He's like, dude, I overreacted. I love Dave. I'm friends with Dave.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was like, he's fun, man. He's fun to poke at.
He really is. No, I can't imagine a disc golf world without Dave. Like, I've had so many great experiences with that dude and learned a lot from him over the years. Oh, and obviously, like, his play speaks for itself. I mean, he's done things that nobody will ever do, really, in disc golf. So.
No, for sure. For
but
sure.
But I still beat him. I still beat him the next time I played him. So,
okay, nice. So, have your breakthrough. You almost win an A tier, and now, like, I can compete.
Yeah.
Do you think was your game at that level, and then therefore you felt confident because your game had got there, or do you think that you had a breakthrough, felt confident, and that brought your game up?
Yeah, I think I was just confident. You know, I definitely still wasn't at an elite level for sure. I don't even think I was 1,000 rated at that time. 1,000 rated was really tough to get to. I won AM Worlds at a 960 rating. So nowadays the kids are winning them. They're all over 1,000 rated, you know, winning AM Worlds. So the rating system has kind of changed, but like I wasn't a top tier player by any means. You know, even me thinking about my game now to then, I was just a gamer, you know, like I was out there playing golf. I wasn't, you know, trying to like, I didn't have elite shot shaping or anything like that. I was just throwing it to point A and then making it into the basket, you know, in least amount of shots as possible. I didn't have like a refined game yet.
Okay. So when did that change? And are you on the road at this point, or are you still home basing and then going out for bursts?
On the road. I didn't have a house really.
Okay, so you're on the road at this point.
Oh, are yeah, full time.
Are you yourself just with disc golf?
Yep.
And was it just prize money or sponsorship, running events, lessons, or was it just
prize money? Yeah, it was pretty tough, man. There was a few. 2008 was another kind of a booger year, man. It was tough for sure. I was getting like last cash a lot. I was like on the last cash tour. I wasn't like finishing very high up. But no, my game was getting there. I had two breakthroughs in my career that I remember that really changed a lot of things. And one of them was from Brad Hammack. One of them was from Josh Anthon. And the Brad Hammack one came during 2008 to where I was a really good putter outside the circle, like an elite level back then. I was making all kinds of stuff outside the circle. But once I got inside the circle, my putt didn't slow down. So I'd three putt quite often. And when you're three putting all the time, you're going to find yourself in that last cash area because you'll have a hot round and then you'll have a hot round, cold round type thing. And I was playing with Brad and I told him that I'm like, yeah, I had just came off of I was leading a national tour and then I got last cash at the national tour. So first round I was leading and then I dropped all the way down. I won $30 or something. And I was like, yeah, I don't know what it is. Like I can't putt like consistently. And he literally took, I had like this power grip, putting grip, like this weird grip, you know, nobody ever really told me how to hold it. And he just put my finger on the rim. And from that point on for like 3 years, I became a really good putter inside the circle. And that changed from me being, you know, pretty good to like one of the better players.
That was Brad Hammack.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm good friends with Brad from back in the day too. I haven't seen him since I came back though. All right. And then what happened with Josh Anthon?
So fast forward probably about a year, 2009, I was playing with him and I had a really great sidearm, but I had no backhand, all power backhand. And he told me, if I wanted to ever be a great player, like I had to learn how to land the disc to where it never had action. So like Stahlheisers and, you know, whenever I would throw a shot, it would land and have a lot of action. It would skip left, skip right, skip forward. And so I took that to heart and I did a lot of field work in that off season and learned how to land all my shots, to where they didn't have as much movement. And from that point on, my backhand game really took a you know, a different level of, well, it just took my game to a different level.
Yeah, that makes sense with the course. I mean, Josh is from Orangevale.
Yeah.
And out of top players that have come from like pitch and putt wooded courses that just have lots of shot shaping variety. It's astounding. Like you could almost argue that the best place to grow up and play disc golf isn't at like a top touring course, but like Kentwood or something, right? I mean,
yeah, like a place to where you really have to understand and how to manipulate the shots and the angles. And then after that, you know, I feel like the power is kind of an easy thing to come by once you know how to throw it, you know, correctly with touch and all those things. Once you have frisbee skills, you know, speeding up really isn't that difficult, I don't think.
No, I agree. I think it's I think it's harder to throw control shots. And the difference, actually, go ahead and explain this, because to a lot of players, throwing accurate shots and shaping shots are two different things. Like you go out to USDGC, shot shaping is not required. You right. play at Rennie Gold, if you can't shape a shot, you lose.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, explain the difference, because this is important.
The difference between shot shaping and
just throwing up to a target.
Right, like, shot shaping, you're manipulating the entire flight of the discs to where, like, you know exactly where it's going to turn 250 feet down the fairway all the way up to 300 feet, and then you're even manipulating the landing. Like, the best players in the world, they're not only throwing the shot that is required for the hole, they're making the hole, the entire fairway, way bigger from the shot that they're choosing, and then they're landing it exactly where they want, which will give them the best chance to, you know, land in the circle.
Right.
Which, yeah, I think is what Josh was getting at, is I would land at the circle and then my shot would have action to where, like, it might stay in the circle, it might be 20 feet, it might be 30 feet, it might be 40 feet, to where when he makes his fairway and he lands, he's guaranteed to be in the circle because his disc is done flying. So it takes the guesswork out of it, to where at that time I was throwing and hitting lines, sure, but then I didn't have the landing down to where my disc would land, and then I would have all kinds of different putts, to where you watch the best players in the world, even nowadays, when they're getting in a groove, they're having 25 footers all day.
Right. Gotcha. So quick question about Josh.
Yeah.
So I heard one time that somebody asked Paul McBeth, or somebody said to Paul, they said, "Hey, Paul, I think you're the best putter in the world." And Paul's response was, "Oh, you've never seen Josh Anthon putt?" I don't know if that was exact words, but Paul's response was to say, "No, I'm not. It's Josh Anthon." Who do you feel, not let's not talk about today, things maybe have changed, but back then, was Josh the best putter in the world at that point, do you feel?
Absolutely. I think there was a few people who were the best. I always remember Dave Fellberg being the best putter, as far as he never missed in the circle, and he made a lot of outside the circle putts. But Josh never really toured that often, right? So he would only come out and splash the tour at a few events. He was more playing a lot of tournaments in California than coming out for the big ones. But, I mean, Josh is still the best putter in the world, in my opinion. I mean, that guy is elite status as far as putting. I played in a tournament, you'll like this, I played in a tournament in Grass Valley, California once, and we were playing with this guy named Shane. And Shane was putting with a warlock the whole round. We're on the lead card, and Shane is just whining and being about his putter not working. Like, I can't believe I'm putting with this, and he's just missing all these putts. And it was getting pretty annoying. And he misses a putt, and it, like, lands right by the basket, and he starts just whining about his putting stroke or the putter. And Josh goes over there, picks it up off the ground, walks over to his 35-footer, makes it, goes over, hands it to him, and says, "There's nothing wrong with your putter."
Are you serious?
This is in a tournament. Like, he literally putted with his putter and said, "There's nothing wrong with your putter." I've never seen anything like it till this day. Oh, but it was the funniest thing ever.
Did he find it funny also? That has to be funny.
He had to have. I mean, I'll never forget it. He literally walked over, grabbed it from under the basket, walked over to his line, made the putt, walked over to him and said, "There's nothing wrong with your putter, dog."
Christ.
So, yeah, I think just from that instance alone, I think Josh is the best putter of all time.
Yeah, I build on that. And the frustrating thing, because I do lessons full time and I'm teaching full time now, and Josh putts wrong.
Yeah, you can't teach that stroke for sure.
All I ever can tell people is Ty Cobb held his bat wrong. Like, he held his bat differently than you teach Little League, and it's like, so he's my Ty Cobb, but in a good way. I like Josh. Ty Cobb was a prick.
Absolutely.
All right, so you're out there, so you're touring at these events. So by 2008, was it still Felberg? I mean, who are the guys out there, top guys at that point?
Same guy. So Felberg, Eric McCabe at the time was playing really well. Not a lot of new people. I was one of the only new guys that was like on tour full time, you know, which was great. I mean, the tour was awesome and super inviting and everything. 2009 came around, same guys, you know. I think that was the year Avery won the world championship. So Nate Doss, and okay. Nate Doss was one of the better players as well. So,
gotcha. I have a question about Nate. So Nate won worlds 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Was he also the top at that time? One of the top, because I always kind of got the impression that he was one of the top players who would just, it just came together at worlds three times. Like he's so consistent. But
I have a theory that certain players are just made for bigger moments, you know? And I think Nate Doss is one of those players to where, once you add a little extra pressure, certain people get better and certain people don't. And Nate Doss is one of those people to where, yeah, I mean, he plays a B tier tomorrow, Nate's might not win that tournament. You know, like in his career, I think I looked at it recently and he has like 40 something wins, which isn't a lot for a three-time world champion.
No, that's what I'm ridiculous.
But he, if you look closer at it, I think 30 of his wins are national tours or higher. So like this dude shows up when he's supposed to show up. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, that's actually, it's real interesting. I wonder, do you think that he just doesn't get hurt by the pressure when other people do? Or do you think that he actually concentrates more and steps it up at that point? Like, oh, I need to focus now. It's a big one. Or both.
I think that. I've also had a theory. I think that major championships are the easier ones to win out of like even the pro tours and stuff. I think that they are, because there's a lot of people who can win at smaller tournaments, even pro tours. But once a major championship, you even put the letter in front of the tournament, you know, half the tournament doesn't have a chance.
Right.
And the same players are the ones out up there every single time. That's why Dave Felberg even told you, like, hey, I've gotten top 10 10 times in a row. Like, I bet if you look at that same list, you could find five other guys who are in the same top 10 those 5 years in a row. And then you sprinkle all kinds of different people in there every other year. I think extra pressure, you know, there's certain players that play well with it, and there's certain players that just, it's tougher.
Gotcha. All right, so it's 2008, 2009, your game's coming together. Brad and Josh have each played a little part in this. I mean, I'm sure lots of players played. I mean, it sounds like you listen to other players. I mean, you take advice and take feedback, right?
Absolutely. No, I was, if you can ask any of those people, I was constantly in their ear asking for advice or tip forms or anything. Definitely a student of the game for a lot of years in my first years on tour.
Yeah, I think it's super important. I got actually a funny story about that. So I was the first one to do the traveling clinics. When I decided to do traveling clinics, I scheduled 155 of them around the country. And there's no YouTube, there's no anything. Almost all the top players are regional, but there was the top Oklahoma guy, the top Nebraska guy, right? They were all over the place. And for the longest time, every time I showed up in a town where one of my touring friends was, were, something came up. They never came to the clinics. And I was hurt by this. I mean, I was like, why aren't my friends showing up to my clinics? And what somebody told me was, that made the most sense. They said, they're like, you don't understand. For 364 days, they're king of their town. They don't want to not be in that role when that day that I come to town.
Right.
And I thought like that, you know, that it made sense, but I was kind of bummed out by it. So along this tour, now I go and I schedule an event in Clearwater, Climo's town. And sure as shit, Climo not only comes to the clinic, but sits there and pays attention. And I went, shit, that's why you're Ken Climo. And that's why these other guys aren't. Right. I don't know if he learned anything from me or not, but the fact was, is he was a student of the game. Ego didn't matter. He was there to get better. And that separated him from literally everybody else on tour. I mean, just about everybody. So you have the same philosophy, apparently. Like you're going to learn from everybody you can learn from.
Absolutely. I'm still learning. I still take into account. I ask questions and I'm constantly changing my game.
That's beautiful. All right. Now your game elevates to the next level. Like now it's, you're still out on the road.
Right.
Are you still eating bread and bologna, or have you like progressed to fast food?
No, I'm still, you know, not really eating the best. I was a pretty skinny kid at the time. But I go into, so 2009 comes along and this is where I went from being, you know, pretty good touring player now to where I went and I jumped into the top 10 in the world. And I stayed there for a long time. I went to Kansas City Worlds and I was on my way to Kansas City. Obviously, I think I was in Iowa before. I've always been a proud person. Like I don't accept money really from anybody. And I had $10 to my name, $10. I'm driving. I run out of gas. I had a Honda Accord. I ran out of gas on my way to Kansas City. And I'm only like 20 something miles away, but I'm in between towns. I'm 4 miles from the next town or something. So I have to walk my butt into town and I go into the gas station and the gas can was $9.99. And I'm like, crap, like I have $10, $9.99. Like I'm not gonna ask anybody for money. But across the way there was a Goodwill. So I walked over to the Goodwill and I made my own gas can, went over, filled it up, went to my car and drove into town. I called Brad Hammack, who was a really good buddy at the time. I actually talk to him all the time still. But I call him up and I'm like, hey, where are you staying? You know, I wanted to get a practice round with him or whatever. And he's like, oh, I'm playing cards at Pete's house. And I'm like, I don't know who Pete is. And he was talking about Pete Cashin. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I love cards. Can I come over there? Hoping that I could find a place to stay, you know. And there was already a bunch of people staying there. But I asked Pete, I'm like, hey, you know, you got any extra space? Like, I got nowhere to stay. And I didn't have any money, you know. And he's like, yeah, you can stay here if you find something on the ground. So I find this little like cubby hole and I end up staying there for the Worlds. Well, there were some people coming in and I was only supposed to stay there a day. So I get my stuff and I'm like getting ready to leave. And Pete's like, where are you going, man? And I'm like, well, you know, they told me that I had to leave because there's more people coming in. He's like, no, that's your spot over there. You're good. So this guy's like the best dude ever. You know, he lets me stay in his little corner. And then he catered to us the whole week. So he literally would have food come in for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So I didn't have to pay for any food. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that I made the lead card in one of the rounds at the World Championships. And I think I got top 10. And once I did that, you know, it went to my head. And I'm like, okay, like I can do this. This is going to be, you know, easier from here on out. I think once you get a nice top finish like that, like at a Worlds or a US or even a national tour or whatever, something clicks and you just got it. And so from that point on, I really never had to worry about money again because I was finishing in the top 10 almost every time.
Gotcha. Funny that you say that. I actually said in my book, the thing that led to me, or one main thing that led to me touring, was I went to Detroit Worlds in 92 and finished eighth. And the minute I finished eighth against the best players in the world, I went, oh shit, I can compete. Let me look into this tour thing. It's exactly, I didn't win, but I finished high enough so that I was one of them.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that really, really helped me during all of that, like you said, nowadays kids really don't have to worry about that, not having 10 bucks or this or that and the other thing. Like, that was real, like, I had to build a lot of character in order to keep going, you know? And the best thing that it ever taught me was, I don't think about the money, you know? Because if you're thinking about the money, I had no money when I got 12th at Worlds or whatever, zero. And I've never one time thought like, oh, this is for $500 or this is for $20,000, you know, or whatever. That's one of the things that has always helped me, is I've always been so competitive that I never thought like, I have to cash, otherwise I can't make it to the next weekend. I was always obsessed with just a higher finish, you know. Getting last cash was great, but not winning the tournament always drove me nuts, or not getting, you know, top four, or not having people watch you. That's always been like my driving motivation.
Right. Okay. So while this is, so you're playing big tournaments, but were you able to like hit B and C tiers and win those for a few $100 here and there? I mean, were you just at the big events?
I was just at the big events.
Okay. So I completely respect that. I had 5 years when I was living in Colorado where I never played more than 3 Colorado tournaments a year. I would only go to the big tournaments where Climo was, and I would get beat. But same spirit of like the smaller tournaments, I would play, I would win. There were good players there, but it never fed that. Like competing against the best in the world and losing was more enjoyable than winning a tournament.
See, now I'm completely the opposite. I would way rather go win a tournament than get beat by the same guys every weekend. So I splash into those little smaller tournaments a lot more often. Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh,
I think there's something to it. You know, I think there's something to going in, winning I'll go and I'll win a couple small tournaments before I play the world championships. That's like part of my warm-up process. You know, because I don't want to go into the world championship and I just got beat by the same guys. I want to play a tournament, win the tournament. The last time that I played disc golf, I won. You know what I mean? I want to have that confidence going into the next one.
Okay. Well, I mean, I've been on the road since December out in the Midwest, and I'm not going to small tournaments because they're small. I'm doing what's called, what I'm calling adventure touring. So I've been in a part of the country where I could play a tournament and then go backpacking for 4 days and then play a tournament and go kayaking for 3 days.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if a big tournament had been in Utah, I would have gone. But so I get that now. But when I was being competitive, I was seeking out. It doesn't mean I like getting beat, but I sought out the biggest tournaments.
Like, see, I would always leave, like there'd be a big A tier the next weekend where all the players would go. I'd drive across the country to play a tier where nobody was at.
I've done that. I've looked.
Yeah, I do that because I'm like, listen, I don't have to prove myself against these guys week in and week out. Like, I'll play them at the majors and then we'll let the cards fall where they may there. You know, I don't need to do that. Like, I want to go see a new place, win a tournament, like I said, and you know, make sure that I'm making money and all that stuff.
Yeah, no, I get that. And when you get a year, are you 40? No,
you're like no, 30, I'm not 40.
33, no, not,
32. Just turned 32 a few months ago. Yeah,
I didn't think, you know, I promise you don't look 40. I was only asking that because we're going back in time so much, and I just hadn't done the math. All right, so this is one of the things then you'll get to enjoy when you turn 40, which is you get even more flexibility.
You know? Oh, I love that. I was just talking to Barry about it, and he was just like, you know, I like playing in the open, but I can kind of – and he's almost 50. I'm like, you should have been doing that when you were 39, man. As soon as I turn 39, like, I'll be playing Masters, guarantee it. But hey, you know, there's different people have different competitive sides for sure.
Yeah, no, I get it. All right, so now you're touring, now you're starting to make money. Now you're winning. You're winning tournaments. You're not broke. Are you? Are you driving a vehicle at this point? Or are you still just kind of cruising with the?
Yeah, yeah. I had a little Honda Accord that I was going out in. Yeah.
All right. So you're traveling. Are you traveling with anybody or?
Not at that time, no.
So you're traveling by yourself. That's a little harder to do back in those days. So you've been on the road ever since then.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. And since, like, you know, since 2010 on, you've been a consistent, steady top player. You win tournaments, you finish top at majors. Have there been any certain highs, or do you think you kind of hit, like in 2010, did you kind of hit this, I'm now an elite player and I've been there for a decade?
Yeah, I feel like that's what's happened. I mean, now we have more players, and I do think that I've gotten better over the years. But I also think that the play has gotten a lot better as well. So I've always been, I feel like, good enough to win it at any point. And that's happened for, you know, I don't know, 10 years or something.
Okay. So I met you in 2015, I think briefly at the Memorial, but then I got to know you a little bit out in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Or Athens, Georgia, and North Carolina, right? I mean, I remember you staying. This is actually my first memory of you. Was we were staying at, if you remember this, I'll be touched. But we were at Schweberger's house for his Schwebby evening that he does every year, And Colin was there, and I don't know if Ricky was there.
I remember.
It was a who's who of like top players there. Sure. And I was in the room, and I heard you from the kitchen say, "So who do you guys think has the best sidearm of all time?"
Yeah.
And then I heard you guys debating it, and I'm sitting in the other room, I'm waiting, and I don't hear my name, but I've been gone for 14 years, right?
Yeah.
And then, so then I walked into the kitchen, I said, "I'm sorry, my ears were burning. Was I missing?" Do you recall that?
I don't recall that, but it's an argument that I always have with Big Germ.
Yeah. So that was my first memory of you, because I was like I was butthurt, but I, you know, like I said, I've been gone for 14 years. Give me a break. And there was no YouTube. So it was like, whatever. I've always said, like, I just want to be in these conversations. Best distance throw. I don't care if you say Simon's better than me, as long as I'm in the sentence with he's better than Scott. That's all you can, as an athlete, that's all you can hope for as you get older, right? Just stay in the conversation. So I remember thinking that, I was like, what do you mean you don't mention me? And I got all, anyways. So, all right. So I'm just curious. So when you played in 2000, had you even heard, like you heard some of the old timers, but a lot of us had quit from the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Brad obviously had, and Barry was still playing, but had you heard about me and some of the other players from back then?
Oh, or? Absolutely, absolutely. I've heard about you. I've looked up all of your guys' stats, how many years you played, what years you played. Like I like looking all that stuff up. I'm a big statistician as far as how good people were, what they played, and all of that stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I'm always just curious, because that the pre-YouTube era, I mean, you had to have a video camera back then, and that video camera wasn't small. It was like it rested on your shoulder and
yeah,
from filming, right? So there's that gap from that era. Not for the players you kept playing. I mean, Barry and Ken, obviously, and Brad, like they kept their games. They didn't stop, but
sure.
All right. So, no, I mean, I love it. And this is like, I had no idea. I'm actually like way more excited than I wanted to talk to you because you're my friend and I wanted to catch up, and I'm going to reach out to you. I had no idea that you went through what we went through in 2005. I didn't know that you had participated in that whole tour life that doesn't, I don't say it doesn't exist, because you can struggle financially on tour as a new player for sure.
But the difference was we were good, you know, we were good players struggling. It wasn't like we were, you know, like bad. Like at that point, I had $10 to my name, and I got 12th at the Worlds that year. You know, I was a good player. That doesn't, I don't think that the good players have to deal with that, you know?
Yeah. No, I think you're it's different, and the sponsorship has gone up. Okay, so speaking of that, early on, you were sponsored by somebody before Prodigy came along. Like who are your early sponsors? Like, who are the first people to get on?
My first ever sponsor was Discraft. After I won Am Worlds, they picked me up. And then after a couple of years, I switched to Innova, and I was with Innova for 5 years. And then okay. I left Innova to go to Prodigy. Was with Prodigy, and then I just left Prodigy a few years ago, and now I'm with Discraft.
Okay. And I love, I mean, that whole thing that Prodigy did out of the gate, I mean, I had only heard about it, but it was so brilliant with you and Bill and Germ and, I mean, and lots of players.
Absolutely, yeah.
Really, really, really smart model. What do you think happened? I mean, why did it not pan out? Is it, like, some people say it's because the touring players is only like a 10th of 1% of the market. Was there a reason why that didn't, the momentum kind of didn't continue? And I'm not knocking Prodigy. I mean, these are my friends.
No, I don't think so. I think what happens is the same with any sport is once they do it, then the other companies have to, you know, do the same thing. And so then when they start offering the same thing, you know, you have a bunch of really good players on the same team, and there's just different paths that you take in life, and that's just what happened. I mean, sure, like hindsight, it would have been great to have all those players still on the same team, you know, but that's just not reality. Like, how many times in the NBA do players stay on the same team? It just doesn't happen. You know, people just go move on, and different contracts and offers and relationships and all that stuff happen, and with different companies, and you know, I think that it was inevitable for that to happen, really.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of Prodigy. I mean, these are my friends from the day, right? So I'm a huge fan. So someone asked, in fact, Zach Tensher asked, what Prodigy disc do you miss the most?
Loaded question, but I respect it. I think, you know, I really enjoyed throwing the M2. They had a mid-range that I really liked. I'll just stick with that. They have a really good mid-range called the M2 that, you know, I had like a bunch of the same run, and it was just have some fond memories with that disc for sure.
Okay. And then Cody Slonim asked, what is your favorite out-of-production Discraft disc? You threw them way back when, so there's some out-of-productions. And I'll even add to that, what are your go-to discs there now? Is there anything that
Let's see. Out of production, probably the Tracker. I don't think they make the Tracker anymore, and that's a pretty good disc. Things that I'm throwing now, I was lucky enough to help design the disc called the Raptor, which is actually my signature disc. And it's very similar to like a really overstable fairway driver, Firebird, or I think it's the Explorer with Latitude, or yeah, basically those are some good comparisons. H1 with Prodigy, so just an overstable fairway driver.
Okay, I mean, so that is your signature disc is the Tracker?
No, it's the Raptor.
I mean, the Raptor. Your signature disc is the Raptor. But it's out of production right now, but they'll be able to this will be live on YouTube forever. At some point that disc is going to be available. I know because of everything, it's not in production at the moment, but early. Where does someone go to buy it?
You just can't get it on the website right now. Like, you can go to probably your local disc golf shop if they're a retailer for Discraft, and a lot of those people will have it. I mean, it's hard to keep this on the shelves anywhere right now, obviously, with everything being so popular and the pandemic, people are just, you know, flooding to the disc golf courses, which is great. But yeah, I'm guessing the local disc golf shop that you have will have some form of the Raptor.
Okay. Is there a difference between the signature Raptor, your signature Raptor and Raptors? Is it a different blend or?
Yeah, just plastics. My signature Raptor is actually swirly Z plastic, so it has some nice color in there, a little bit stiffer and more overstable than like an ESP run or something like that. But I mean, same mold, so.
Okay. Well, and the thing too is that if people understand is that when you buy a signature disc, you're supporting that pro and their ability to do this for a living. And if you, you know, it often costs the exact same amount of money, but you can buy a disc that actually is going to support a player that you follow who maybe inspired right. you this to begin with. If you got a choice, choose the signature disc. Why not? Right.
Absolutely. Every time.
So every time. Yeah, I do. I'm a huge, I mean, I've said this to anyone who will listen. When I came back to the sport, I haven't met anybody on tour I don't like, male or female. There are players who are very competitive, but it's sports. And so the fact that they're competitive or maybe are intense or have a temper, they're good guys and good girls.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and so like, I'm such a supporter of everybody out on tour. So buy the Paul Ulibarri Raptor, support what you're doing, make up for all the years that you had to, you paid your dues, right?
Yeah.
Like, why not? Sure. All right. So Kai Chang had a question. He was asking about the transition from amateur to pro. Like, yours mm-hmm. happened pretty, but was there a transition or was it just you're playing with better players, same game?
Mine was kind of frustrating, honestly, looking back, because once I won Am Worlds, it was my only advanced win. And then I was a professional. There was no staying in amateur. Obviously, once you win that tournament, you're a pro, especially back then. I really feel to this day that I wish I would have stayed amateur for a little longer and learned how to win a little bit more and, you know, done that whole thing, because at the time in disc golf, and it's still a little bit around, is once you start winning advanced tournaments, like you're forced to play pro. And I think a big part of it is they wanted a bigger pro field. Like the professionals that were playing back then, you know, would call you bagger or whatever, and they want your entry fee.
Yes, and so we
did. Absolutely. And so I do feel like I moved up pretty quick from that point. But there was no staying in amateur, especially in the time that I lived in. You know, after winning Am Worlds, it would have been like, I would have never heard the end of it. I would have been laughed off the tour, probably.
Well, let me ask you a specific question then, because there are multiple divisions. And I put out a video a couple months ago about when I thought a player should move up. And I've become a firm believer that you should stick around and win a couple. Number one, when you move up to a division, you're basically donating money for a while. So I think that you're allowed to cash in with stacks of discs. Like you paid your dues in that division. But I also think, like we talked about earlier, that there's a skill to going out to lunch with a two-stroke lead and having it not screw with your head. I mean, these are learned skills. Or how to come back from four strokes down with 18 holes to go because you've won from that position before.
Right.
What do you tell players when they say, when should I move up? What do you tell them?
I tell them when they're ready, and that has a lot to do with themselves. There's a lot of people who are different. Some people are ready to move up right away because they can't play, you know, with the same guys every single weekend, and they need that competitiveness. But some guys move up too quick, and then they get intimidated by, you know, the situation, and then they get beat around for a couple of years. So I think it's up to the individual, but I think it's when you truly believe you belong, that's when you should move up.
Okay. So now Max Garcia wanted to know, how does it feel being one of the old guys on tour? Like, you're not old, but I mean, you're not, but you have, among the
touring, I'm an old guy on tour now for sure.
Yeah, you've been
it
on tour.
It sucks.
It sucks. Okay, why? Tell me.
It's just horrible. You got these young kids coming up, and they're calling you old, and I'm like, dang, I used to be the young kid. Like, what the heck happened? But it also keeps me motivated, which is also good, you know.
Okay.
But no, it definitely sucks. I hate getting old. It's the worst.
Oh my God! Preach on, brother. I want to the people that said it's going to be better when you're older, I want to punch them in the face. No, it's not.
Absolutely not.
Being in your 20s is fantastic. I've told everyone who will listen that you should, if you love disc golf, you should go out and tour in your 20s. College will be there when you're 27. Yeah. If that's what you want to do. But if you go to college and have a career and a family and kids, tour ain't going to be there when you're 53. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like I think the 20s is a great time to do nothing with your life.
Yeah. Go out on tour and make fun of the old guys out there. Yeah. Do it.
Yeah. No, hey, trust me. Trust me. I know.
Oh, I was there. I remember we had when I was in my early 20s, our tour was literally called Team Smash Dinosaurs. And now I'm the dinosaur. So it came full circle.
Remember that. And I remember who the dinosaurs were you were referring to. I won't say.
Yeah. But now I'm the dinosaur. So I deserve it for sure.
I might have actually even talked to you about that in like 14 or 15. Because I remember hearing about that. And I there were some people that thought that was like disrespectful or something. And I was like, I was like, I was the biggest fan of it because you're athletes. Like, you're competing, like blowing yourself up to go after the old guard. I mean, that's like part of sports. I mean, everyone wants to knock LeBron. Not a lack of respect for LeBron. It's like, screw that old guy.
Yeah.
No, I'm a huge fan. Wow, it's so funny. I'm calling you the old guy on tour. I'm 51. Hey, by the way, my last tournament, I averaged 10.29 over three rounds, and I was 9 strokes ahead of the top open player. So,
why didn't you play open?
You too. Because that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen every weekend.
That's good shooting, though. Congratulations, that is good shooting.
Thank you. Actually, I'll ask about this because you made it your goal. I was, you know, following you. I've always followed you. Like a year ago, you wanted to get your rating back up to 10.30.
Yeah, guy bet me I couldn't do it.
Yeah, and you did it.
Yeah, he bet me $1,000 I couldn't do it within the span. And I think I was 1,017 at the time, and he bet me $1,000 I couldn't do it in a certain amount of time.
And you did it.
Yeah, ratings don't mean anything. Like, they're the easiest thing ever. I firmly believe that, yeah.
You think it's easier to build your rating up at major tournaments than big tournaments, or
just pick your tournaments. You can just pick tournaments that rate well, and then you'll be a high rated player. There's certain people, I won't name them, but I know for a fact there's top players who literally don't play small tournaments because they're afraid of ruining their rating. So in that sense in itself, I don't think rating should even be a thing for professionals.
No, I get that. I actually, because I was last year
and
off.
And sorry to interrupt you, but that was the reason that I made the bet, is I said that. I'm like, ratings are ridiculous. And this guy's like, yeah, it's because you're not one of the top rated guys. And I'm like, I could be a top rated guy if I wanted to. And then that's when he's like, I'll bet you $1,000 you can't get to 10:30 in whatever the amount of time. I'm like, bet.
That's rad. So I actually, because I had taken all of last year off, I hadn't been playing or anything. I take these periods. So I was down to like 980 something. And then so when I came back out in December, I said, I'm going back in the road. I'm like, my goal was to get back to 1,000 rated. And I'm 51, right? So 1,000 rated is still pretty good. And on the last ratings jump, I was 999. And on the last ratings jump, I was checking to see, and I actually jumped to 1010.
Wow. And that's a good rating.
I went, oh shit, that's pretty damn good for 51 years old. I'm like, hell yeah. So like, so I didn't really care much about ratings until I had one that I could be happy about. Then I'm like,
yeah.
It's mad.
Yeah, ratings are awesome. Yeah.
So this is, man, I'm so stoked. So I need to know, like, you're touring right now. I mean, you're living in North Carolina. You're actually at Jeremy Colling's house. Mm-hmm. And actually, I do want to ask you one more question I want to ask you something about Jeremy, because he's not there, right?
No.
Oh, good. Let's talk about him. Okay. And so I'll save my last question for the end. So you and Jeremy have been close friends forever.
Yes.
All right. And so Jeremy is among all the newer players. He's the one I've connected to the most. I love that guy. I feel very close to him. I care about him a lot. We've gotten into a lot of prank wars, me and him.
Yeah.
He is so much fun to prank.
Yes.
There was a specific prank that I heard about from you, but I want to hear your side of it. So the prank was Jeremy had to leave a tournament before the awards ceremony. Do you remember this?
I don't remember.
Oh, so maybe then they might not be this might be dead time on the podcast. This is where I convinced everybody to start texting him about how unprofessional he was.
I vaguely remember this.
Okay. So then this is, we won't even go down that rabbit hole because this will conversation. So,
okay.
But I remember you had messaged me at the time to tell me that he was all freaked out and I was really, really pleased. So Germs, you're staying at Germs house. You guys are now co-hosting. Tell me about that briefly, where they can find you.
Well, we do the commentating for Jomis.
Right. And that's, do you guys do anything together besides Jomez, or is that your gig?
We do that, and then we also are involved with the practice rounds through Jomez Pro, and that's pretty much about it.
Okay. Somebody asked, I don't even have it here, but I'm going to ask you. They wanted to know, how can we never beat Big Drum in practice rounds?
Because I'm practicing.
There you go. That's, I was really hoping you would say that. That's the only answer, because who gives a shit? All right. You have a YouTube channel and you are promoting a lot. I mean, you're clearly one of the best teachers out there because you're a student of the game. So tell me what you're doing on your YouTube channel. I'll make sure I link it in all the descriptions and stuff. So what are you doing?
No, so honestly, similar to what you're doing, I looked at your YouTube channel before we did this, and we do similar things. Like, I just do little quick tips. Every week I put out one a week, and it's called Down the Fairway. And I do like a 3-minute tip of the week type thing with different pros and things like that for people to, you know, I wanted to come up with something instead of watching an hour-long clinic or something, somebody can just type in like putting or whatever, and then they'll find like 3 really quick tips from different pros or different, you know, theories and things like that. And so I've been doing that since quarantine.
Okay, I think that's beautiful. People are shocked that I link and I promote and talk about other teachers, like as if we're competing with each other in a sport where there's 10 million players, like as if 10 of us are competing with each other or something like that. It's so stupid. I haven't checked out your stuff, but I will, because I learned from everybody. So I'll definitely take a look. But what I know of you, there's no question your content's going to be good. So
I appreciate that. I do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I actually just made a video about how to choose a disc golf teacher. And what I said on the video, and I believe this, is that the end goal of what I try to get someone to do and what you get them to do is going to be like 97% the same. I mean, we agree on how to throw a disc, but our approach to teaching people is going to be different. We're different people, different personalities, different styles.
Absolutely.
And so when you look for a teacher, it's not about who has the best information. It's about who has the best teaching style, I think. Uh-huh. So if someone connects with your personality more than mine, you'll be a better teacher than me for them all day. And so I encourage people to look around and find a style. And so I'll link to your videos. If you check out your videos and it's clicking what you're trying to communicate, then you're the go-to. And it also
Absolutely agree. But yeah. I say check them all out. You know, one way of teaching, you say we're going to be saying the same thing, and the way you explain it to some brain might work, and it could be that little moment. You know, just like I had that moment with Brad Hammack. Hopefully these things that you and I and the rest of the people who are posting these things on YouTube or doing the clinics, hopefully we can do that for the next generation as well.
Oh, I'm sure we can. I mean, so that was my final question. Where do you go from here? Because you're out touring. I mean, you know, you can tour and make a living forever, but you have such in the sport and so much experience and connections. You also have the advantage of everybody likes you. That opens doors. And now you're doing the Jomez thing. Like, where do you see your future going in the sport? I mean, you're still a top player. You can still win Worlds this year, next year. But where do you see that your career going at this point?
It's a tough question because I am, you know, on my last elite years of being. Like, I think it's really important for an athlete to understand that and then maximize what they have when they have it. And I know that, you know, I got about 5 more years maybe of really good disc golf. And so during that 5-year span, you know, I want to become the best disc golfer that I could possibly be, because I don't want to be done and then think, man, I wish I could have, you know, those last couple years or something like that. But past that, I mean, I want to just keep growing my brand and teaching. The Jomez thing has been great from the exposure of disc golf and even my own brand. And just keep, you know, I can't believe that disc golf has grown right now. And I just want to be there when it keeps on growing and just have, you know, my place in disc golf, because it is my life and it has given me everything that I have. So I want to make sure that I keep a little stake in it for sure.
Okay. You have a, and I should have already known this, I apologize. You have your personal Facebook page, but do you have any other social media that where someone could hook up and follow you besides just the YouTube channel, or is YouTube, that's your plan?
No, YouTube is something I just started. I have an Instagram and you can follow me on that at @1Yuli, and then Facebook, I'm all full, but if you send me a nice enough message, I might delete somebody else. Maybe a little.
No, that's cool. Do you have anything else? I mean, anything else you want to?
No. Well, the one thing I definitely wanted to say is I wanted to thank you for having me on, and thank you personally for everything that you've done and your career and everything. I mean, it was you guys laying the groundwork for my generation. And I mean, you inspired all of us. And I still, when I talk about all the old timers and the greats, you're in that conversation. And I just appreciate everything that you've done and for me and the sport. And hopefully I can follow in your guys' footsteps and be the same sort of guy. So I appreciate you, Scott.
And that means the world to me. And you guys are on the path. I mean, you're pursuing things outside of competition. My one piece of old man wisdom for you is that the people that pursued disc golf interest outside of just competing are doing okay. And the players that didn't look forward past that, they're the ones who are bitter.
Right.
Because they're no longer competing, but they didn't build that brand. And so what you're doing with Jomez and the teaching, like, there's a very lucrative career forever if you stick to that. And so my only advice to you is to keep pursuing that, because you're good. And I can't even state this strongly enough. People like you. And when people like you, doors just open. And so if you keep doing you, you're going to be doing, you'll be fine. So
thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the kind words. That's really nice to hear.
All right. And so your Germs house, I'm going to think of something to do to sabotage this house while he's gone. Cause please. I can't miss this opportunity. I'm going to think of something, but all right. Hey, cool. I appreciate everything. Thanks so much again, man. You're the coolest dude. I can't wait to see you on tour, which I'll bump into you again. And, till next time.
Love it. Thanks again, buddy.
All right. Thanks, man. Bye.